Don't move a muscle. The podcast is starting.
Hello, and welcome to Podtrificus Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. We are here to do Chapter 15, The Forbidden Forest. I'm your host, Cassie.
And I'm Joe.
And we always start with the chapter summary, and it's Joe's turn this week to do it.
Okay, so this chapter, The Forbidden Forest, starts off with Harry and Hermione being punished by Professor McGonagall. They're taken to see her, and she's dealing with another student, Neville. She found going to warn them about Malfoy knowing about the dragon. She believes that Harry made up the story, and they accidentally tricked Neville along with Malfoy. So their punishment, the first thing we learn about is they lose 50 points apiece. So yes. So Gryffindor loses 150 points overnight, and nobody's happy about it. So they finally find out their detention is just at 11 o'clock at night, meet Filch in front of the main hall. So the three of them go meet Filch and Malfoy. Filch takes them to Hagrid's hut, and Hagrid takes them into the Forbidden Forest, where they are split off. They run into several centaurs, and eventually Harry finds the dead unicorn after Malfoy is scared away, along with the fearless Fang, and he runs into this cloaked figure and is saved by Ferenczine, I believe is how you pronounce his name.
Ferenczine, yeah.
Okay.
I think that's what Hagrid says in the movie.
All right. So Ferenczine, a centaur that they hadn't met yet, rescues him, and then Harry and Hermione end the chapter by explaining everything to Ron.
You really need to start writing these down.
I think that was
Long. It is a long chapter. Like a lot happens. Yeah. You did leave out before.
Not long enough, but I left something out.
Well, first of all, you left out why they're going into the forest. They're going into the forest because Hagrid says that something's been killing unicorns and they need to find out what and why. And also, prior to all this happening, Harry overhears Quirrell in a classroom kind of whimpering.
Yes.
Saying like, no, not again, not again. I don't want to do this, that kind of thing.
Yes. And he believes that Snape has finally gotten to him.
Yes.
And now Snape has the information to get past Quirrell's trap.
Which accelerates sort of the problem here. Like we talked about in the previous chapter, how all of the like Stone and Snape and Quirrell stuff kind of gets pushed to the side for a little while for the dragon subplot. Mm-hmm. But now it's back, and Harry is kind of torn between, does he act, you know, does he do something to try to stop Snape, or does he stop meddling after the trouble that it got him in? Because he's like, I just lost all those house points, all of Gryffindor, and if Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff hate me, I'm swearing off this life. I'm going to be a good kid from now on. So Harry's kind of torn between those two worlds. But yes, otherwise your chapter summary is fine.
Just fine. I'll take it.
My first note for this chapter is poor Professor McGonagall is dragged out of bed at like midnight, first to catch Malfoy, and then again after Filch catches Harry and Hermione and Neville. And I feel so bad for the teachers that they not only have to teach and live at the school, but also police the school at night, apparently.
Well, I'm wondering how Malfoy got caught, because I don't think anyone tattled on Malfoy. I think McGonagall might have just been on the astronomy tower looking up at the night sky.
Maybe. I like that idea. Although McGonagall is not much of a stargazer, because Hermione,
later in the chapter,
Hermione says later on that McGonagall tells her that astrology and fortune telling is
very imprecise.
Yes, and it's an imprecise branch of magic, which I like that traces as far back as this book, because that becomes a major plot point in book three. And I like also that McGonagall is poised as this very rational and scientific figure.
Yes,
like that.
But even Ferenczine says that like reading the planets can be like they can be read wrong even by centaurs.
Yes. Yeah. And I have a whole bunch of stuff to talk about that, but we should go in some kind of chronological order here. I did feel very bad for Neville in this scene when he gets in trouble, because McGonagall is saying this thing like, you tricked him into coming out at night. That was very wrong of you. And there's a quote here. Harry caught Neville's eye and tried to tell him without words that this wasn't true, because Neville was looking stunned and hurt. And it's just so upsetting, because Neville has so few friends that for him to think that Harry and Hermione and Ron sold him out like this, it's awful.
What I don't like is they never apologize. They never talk about explaining anything to him.
No.
He's totally left out of the loop, because they could have explained, like, yes, you did try and save us and you actually would have helped if you hadn't gotten caught.
And I mean, I understand them not wanting to say, like, oh, the dragon thing was true. Just don't tell anyone, Neville, but not even an apology. Like, hey, Neville, we're sorry that you got detention.
Yeah. Like,
it's bad.
We can hope it happens, between the lines, but it doesn't seem like it does.
It's not written.
Yeah.
Instead, we get to hear Harry crying about how he goes from the most popular kid in school to hated, but no apology for Neville.
No apology for Neville. And he mentions how much it must have taken for Neville to go out at night.
Oh,
risk
yeah.
Everything to try and help Harry and Hermione.
McGonagall also says something interesting in that scene where she's kind of scolding the kids and punishing them. She says it's dangerous for students to be roaming the castle at night, especially these days, which struck me as odd that she clearly knows something is going on in the castle. I mean, she knows that the stone is there. So that's what I think she's probably referring to, that, you know, like, people are going to be trying to break in and take this stone. It's super valuable and rare. So you shouldn't be walking around at night. But I don't know, like, if a teacher said that to me, that would make me feel very unsafe.
Yeah, I'm curious if she's saying something that she thinks they know.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
It's that, or she was on top of the astrology tower and she's like, Mars is bright.
Maybe. And so after receiving this punishment and falling out of everybody's good graces, Harry swears not to meddle in things going on at the school anymore. He's like, I'm going to mind my own business. I'm not going to sneak around anymore. I'm not going to spy. And unfortunately for Harry, he doesn't really have a choice in the matter. He's always kind of pulled into this trouble. He doesn't really get to be just a normal kid. It seems like this stuff falls on him.
He puts himself in those situations. Like, yes, he does walk by a room where Quirrell is whimpering, but like, he willingly goes into that room. Nothing happens right then and there, but he's like, oh, if I keep going, I'll find Snape.
So this is something interesting. It's something that's going to tie into the bigger discussion I want to have this episode about justice and agency in the series. So Harry, like you said, he does kind of find himself in these situations, but he does to an extent seek them out. He wants to know the truth. Like, he wants to know what's going on and he wants to make things right. And he's ignoring kind of the external rules and authority figures that others are following. So like later in the chapter, Hermione says, like, let's just tell Dumbledore, like, why have we not done that from the start? And Harry's like, nobody is going to believe us.
Yeah, they have no proof. They're just accusing a professor that they openly hate.
Yeah. And there's a whole discussion to be had about why he feels that way as well.
But what the way they describe it, the way they talk about things at the end of this chapter makes me think something that I hadn't realized. At this point, they're in their head saying, we have to stop Snape from getting this stone because he's just trying to get rich.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So there's a weird form of justice there.
Yes.
You know, later on, all of this is justified as we're stopping Voldemort. And they realize that that's what they've been doing without meaning to. At this point, they hate a professor. They don't want him to steal something and get rich.
Yes. But I mean, it's more than stealing something and get rich. It's more the stealing something, you know, taking advantage of his position as a professor at the school and taking something that doesn't belong to him. But it's this contrast between external rules and authority that's kind of set by the school, like don't go out at night, which notably Hermione to an extent follows. She starts to drift into Harry's world as the series goes on more and more. But Harry very much is following his own autonomy. He's saying, this is what I believe is right. And I don't care if it's incompatible with the external rules. I'm going to do what I feel is right and enact my own form of justice and be a part of justice.
Mm-hmm. And he only starts second guessing that as people stop liking him.
Yeah. And I think we see as the series goes on, too, that he stops caring as much.
Yes. Right now he's 11.
Yeah.
Everyone liking him matters.
Yeah. And he was at the top of the world before. He was the winner of the Quidditch match. He won them all these points and then lost them in one night. So it's a big shift from
him. Yeah. He even goes to Wood and offers to resign from the Quidditch team.
Yes. When Wood's like, no.
No, what's wrong? How are we going to win anything if we don't have a seeker?
Yeah. So I want to set that up here, this contrast, because that's going to come into play with a later discussion that I want to have. But we got to get there first.
Okay.
They go down for detention and Filch calls Hagrid an oaf in front of the students, which I thought was really horrible.
Filch doesn't care at all.
It's just crazy to me to think that the one person right now that Filch likes in the school is Snape.
I mean, that's not very crazy to think.
They're both horrible.
Before calling Hagrid an oaf, says, I wish I could shackle you to the ceiling by your wrists.
He says some
things. I have the chains in my office. I grease them regularly. I maintain these wrist shackles so I can strap children to ceilings. It's a shame I'm not allowed to do that anymore.
That is horrible, don't get me wrong, but to like openly insult Hagrid in front of the students just seems awful to me.
I mean, neither are good, but weighing the two.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'd rather he calls Hagrid an oaf than tortures children, but still. Oof.
And he's openly very happy that he's punishing these kids. And he's like, oh, going into the forest, I'll be back at dawn to pick up the pieces. Which, by the way,
they're out all night.
They're taking the kids away from
sleep
entirely for that day.
I guess you have to hope it's like a Friday night or something, you know, they could sleep in on Saturday
maybe, but still
it does. Yeah. And it also seems contradictory of your punishment for wandering the castle at night is to wander in the woods at night.
Well, that could be like, oh, you smoked a pack, you smoked a cigarette, smoked the whole pack.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah,
you know, here's a lot of it and suffer. Yeah.
And also, like, you can see the danger that you, whenever I say the danger, I think of Breaking Bad. This is the danger that you're putting yourself in by going out at night.
Yes. Everything's worse at night, especially in the forest.
Yeah. So they go down to the forest. They learn that they're going to find out why somebody is hunting unicorn. I decided to do research about unicorns because I was also going to do research about centaurs. The centaur research I got a lot for. Unicorns are not that interesting, it turns out. Like, I looked into like mythological backgrounds for them and, you know, like why they might be for Rowling a pathway to immortality. And I did not find anything.
They're just this pure.
Yes.
Innocent creature.
Yes. And that,
very
that
defenseless.
Is justified by, not defenseless. The pure and innocent and honorable thing absolutely is justified with other portrayals of it. The defenseless thing, not so much. They're seen as very strong and stalwart traditionally. And they are the like national animal of Scotland or something.
How does that work?
I don't know. Scotland is associated with the unicorn because they're seen as unicorns and Scotland are seen as independent and strong.
Okay.
And it is notable that Hogwarts is located in Scotland, which might be a consideration for putting them in the forest for Rowling.
All right. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, but I didn't turn up too much about them. I did think it was interesting, though, that they're the person that slew that killed these unicorns to take their blood. Ferenc says that it's a monstrous act. That only a person that was desperate to live would do it, and they would live a cursed life. And Harry basically says, like, if they're going to live a cursed life, why would they want to be immortal? Isn't it just better to die? And Ferenc is like, to you and me, yeah, but to this sick person, whatever. But he says it's monstrous to slay one.
Well, to go past that, he says that, like, they'd be willing to do it knowing they'd get a full life back.
Yes.
Drinking from the elixir of life.
That's basically what he implies. Like, somebody would only do it if they know they just have to live long enough to get another option towards immortality. But he says it's monstrous to slay a unicorn for its blood. And Harry, like, he asks him, like, Harry, do you know why somebody would want to kill a unicorn? And he's like, I don't know. We've only worked with the tail hairs and the horns in classes before. And I'm like, if it's monstrous to slay them for the blood, wouldn't it be kind of monstrous to take off their horns? It seems like a contradiction to me.
I mean, you were the one that did the research on the unicorns, well, but you could think maybe they come off like deer antler once a year.
Do deer shed their antlers?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can like just kind of find them in the woods.
Oh, I didn't know that at all. I thought they were bones.
Kind of, but they grow back every year.
Okay. Wow. All right. I had no idea. Okay. So scratch everything you just said about unicorns.
I mean, I could be totally wrong. We don't know all the biological information about unicorns.
Yeah. We'll have to find a Scottish person and ask them. So that's my rant about unicorns. I have a lot about centaurs. I don't know if you're ready to get into that.
Should we talk more about, like, should we get them to the point where we've met the centaurs?
Okay, probably.
So Filch straps them off. Malfoy starts freaking out.
Yeah, he's like, how dare you make me do this? This is servant work. It's dangerous in there. If only my father knew. Just classic Malfoy stuff.
He starts acting that way when he starts talking to Hagrid. Talking to Filch, he's saying, like, oh, we can't go in there at night. There's all sorts of things in there. Werewolves, I heard. And Filch just says, that's your problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Filch is horrible, but that's a pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then Filch is gone. He's talking down to Hagrid immediately. This is servant stuff. Wait till my father hears about this. And I loved.
Yeah, Hagrid says, if your father heard about this, he'd tell you that's what it's like at Hogwarts.
Yeah. If you think he'd prefer, you can start packing up now and you can go home.
Yeah, it's nice to see a little bit of tough justice enacted on Malfoy because he really is just a piece of garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Malfoy repeats to Hagrid, like, it's dangerous in there. And Hagrid's like, nothing's going to attack you as long as you're with either me or Fang. And Malfoy's like, oh, I'll take Fang. And Hagrid's like, well, your choice. Fang is a coward. Which I like the idea that Hagrid's like, nothing will attack Fang. But he's also terrified of everything.
Yeah. Like, oh, you won't get hurt if Fang's around. Fang abandons Harry not much later.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, it's a dog. Yeah, so Hagrid splits them off into two groups. He takes Harry and Hermione with him in a clear act of favoritism and sends Malfoy and Neville away with Fang, which I feel is a little irresponsible.
I mean, splitting them up in general is irresponsible. I get like, cover the forest and try and figure it out by the end of the night.
But he knows they're dealing with something really serious and dangerous here.
Yes, he's going around with a crossbow.
Yeah.
And he left two 11-year-old boys with a dog.
Yeah. And they, at this point, don't know how to do a lot of magic. Like, Hagrid has to say, like, okay, let's practice sending up sparks with our wands in case we find anything.
Yeah, I liked that a lot. Like, he says, green sparks in the air with your wand if you find the unicorn, red if you're in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And he has them practice.
Yeah.
Which is a smart thing to do.
He doesn't say, like, here's how to defend yourself.
No, just I'll come running with my crossbow.
Yeah. I really question the judgment about this detention. But we'll talk about that at the end of the chapter because they make some choices, the teachers of this school.
And I'm wondering how much of a say Hagrid had in this. Like, I wonder if he asked them to help out, and maybe he was thinking because it was partially his fault they got in trouble.
I could see that, yeah.
He was like, oh, you know, you could do it with me and we'll go find this unicorn.
Yeah, at like the weekly Hogwarts staff meeting, somebody's like, who wants to deal with detention? And Hagrid's like, kind of got him in this situation.
It was my dragon they put on the top of that tower.
But I mean, even if he was trying to save them from a really dreadful detention, he kind of gave them a super dangerous one in as the alternative.
Yes.
So while Hagrid, Hermione, and Harry are exploring the forest, they come across first one centaur named Ronan. Ronan is an Irish name meaning little seal.
Little seal? Like the animal?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. Seal is normally spelt with an A, right? It's just the Pokemon seal that has two E's.
Yes, but both seals are
like a seal and then a seal like an animal. Yeah, there are two different ones, but they're spelled the same way. They're homonyms.
You're the English major.
Yeah, I sometimes I realize that I learn to read by playing Pokemon games and it doesn't always work out well. But yeah, so it means little seal. I think like the animal seal. That is the only information I could find about Ronan the name and Ronan the centaur. He's not important. But he does say that Mars is bright tonight.
Several times.
Yes. To Hagrid's annoyance. Mars is the Roman god of war, Ares in Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. And so obviously Mars is bright tonight means that conflict is coming, challenge is coming. So that is kind of foreshadowing what's going to happen in this chapter and later chapters, I imagine. Bane shows up. He is another centaur. Bane, of course, is a word meaning great distress or annoyance. Since I'm reading Lord of the Rings, I just think of Isildur's Bane. But yeah, that's the name chosen for that centaur.
And he's described as more wild.
Yes. This is an interesting thing. I did like Bane as in great distress or annoyance because Hagrid is bothered by the centaurs keeping like continuously saying like Mars is bright tonight. But yes, more wild. That is really important. So centaurs, of course, are a mythological creature. And the way that they are portrayed is kind of torn between these two natures. They're liminal beings. So they're torn between their animalistic wild selves, the horse self, and the human self, because they're half human, half horse. Mm-hmm. So Bane being more wild, he's more in touch with that animalistic side. Ferenz, by contrast, is more willing to believe that astrology can be flawed, that the way that the centaurs look at the world and choose not to act in certain scenarios is not always right. So Ferenz is leaning more towards that side of the humanistic, the noble, the rational. So the most prominent centaur in Greek mythology is Chiron. His father is the Titan Cronus. So he does have like noble lineage. There are other centaurs, but Chiron is the most well-known and he is the most humanistic to the point where his front two legs are human legs and his back two are horse legs. Okay. So again, he's siding more with that humanistic side.
So he's a human and just his butt is a horse.
Yes.
Like just horse comes out of his butt. Yeah, literally coming as
butt is a horse body and hind legs.
Okay.
We can look at some Greek art later if you want.
I don't know if I need to.
So he's the son of the Titan Cronos, and he is learned in arts and sciences. He knows medicine. He knows astrology. He knows all of these things that, again, makes him more human. And he eventually decides to become a teacher and a tutor of humans, which, not to spoil anything, but this is not the last time Ferenz shows up in the series. So Ferenz is very much modeled off of Chiron, I believe. So it's that interesting contrast that we're seeing with Bane, who's wild, who's animalistic, and Ferenz, who is very much like the more human centaur.
If you want to get a little racist.
Sure. I mean, there's a politics of race going on here. Absolutely.
Let's look at the description of Bane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's a definite setup that Rowling has here.
So black haired and bodied and wilder looking than Ronan. And then let's see where Ferenz is described.
He's Palomino, which is apparently a genetic like type of horse that's like golden skinned.
So he looked younger, had white blonde hair and a Palomino body, which mm-hmm. you said was golden skinned.
Golden light colored.
He had astonishing blue eyes like pale sapphires.
Yeah.
So we have this wild,
dark black, hair, yeah.
centaur.
Yeah. Contrasted with the noble, white, light-haired, blue-eyed centaur.
Yeah.
It's a little messed up. And, you know, you can argue that that goes back to color symbolism, white being purity, dark being blackness, evil, that kind of thing. But those distinctions are very much grounded in the racial understandings that led to them. So
yeah,
it's a little icky. And there is also a politic of race going on within the wizarding world with the centaurs, which we'll see in later books.
Yes, we won't.
Yeah, we're not going to go touching too far that into now. That. But yeah, the whole centaur thing is a little icky. but yeah, so they run into Ronan and Bane. they all say the Mars is bright tonight thing. Malfoy scares Neville and Neville sends up Spark. So Hagrid goes running after them to check
leaving Harry and Hermione alone. And in his mind, Red Sparks, they're in trouble. The danger is there.
Yeah.
So
I guess
Harry and Hermione will be fine here. I'm not going to take them with me to danger.
Yeah.
But
like 2 minutes before that, he sees something and he's like, get off the path, like stay behind me, and really concerned about this thing in the forest. And then 3 minutes later, he's like, just stay there. I'm going to go check on the other.
Well, it seems like it's a long time because...
Yeah, it does take him a while.
Well, it takes him... No, it takes him a while to finish talking to the centaurs.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
they see the thing a little bit before they see the centaurs. Mm-hmm. And the centaur conversation apparently takes a while.
Yes. Yeah. It still, again, makes me question Hagrid's judgment a little bit. But it's also just like they shouldn't be here in the first place. So like you've already made this mistake.
It's all irresponsible.
Yeah.
There are four children in the Forbidden Forest at night.
And so this leads to Hagrid shuffling the groups up a little bit. He puts Harry with Malfoy and Fang and says, you'll be a lot harder to scare. So you deal with him.
And doesn't he like whisper, I'm sorry? Oh, wait, yeah. I highlighted that. Well, let me read that word for word. Oh, just because I highlighted this, too. After they stop talking to the centaurs, Hermione says with an interesting emphasis, are there many of them in here?
Yeah. Yeah, I did not care for that much either.
No, me neither. Let's just tread on past.
I mean, I don't want to seem like we're glossing over this. It's just that it's talked about a lot more in book five that I feel like that's the time for this discussion.
Yeah. So like, in a while, we'll
go
into a lot of detail.
But it
it's a problem.
Yeah. And it given what happens in book five with this and the character that does like the centaurs, it's just weird that Hermione would be making a comment very similar to that early on. But Hermione is an evolving character, and I doubt that Rowling had the centaur plot line fleshed out in her head for book five as of writing book one. But yeah, that's all I'll say about book five. Maybe. We'll see.
Till we get there.
Yeah. But you were looking for the quote.
No, I found it.
Okay.
Right. We're changing groups. Neville, you stay with me and Hermione. Harry, you go with Fang and this idiot. I'm sorry.
Ugh, I mean, Draco deserves it.
Yeah. He just scared Neville in the middle of the Forbidden
Forest.
Well,
not just that, but before they even went in the forest, he basically said, like, Hagrid, you do servant's work. The implication being, Hagrid, you are a servant.
Yes. And that was always clear of, like, Malfoy's mindset.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Hagrid is not wrong.
But, yeah. But Hagrid just sprinted through the forest.
Yeah.
Crossbow at the ready.
Yeah. He was worried these kids are going to be, like, killed or something.
Yes.
And it's just Malfoy being an idiot. So Harry and Malfoy follow along the path. They keep following the unicorn blood, which seems to be getting thicker. So they know they're heading towards something. And eventually they find the unicorn. And its killer, which is a figure that is slithering, Rowling uses the word, which we later learn that this figure is Voldemort. Friends all but tells Harry that. So that word slithering is really interesting because it's part of this pattern that we'll see. And I think maybe the first occurrence of it, of Voldemort being associated with snakes.
Yes, but it says a slithering sound made them freeze.
Sure.
So it was like the cloak. That Voldemort is wearing is sliding, slithering across the ground. But yes, I do see that.
Yeah.
Like immediately you hear slithering, you think snake.
Which is just one letter off from Snape.
Oh.
Yes. So Malfoy gets terrified and runs off along with Fang. Harry, though, feels this burning in his head from his scar.
Yes, his scar is hurting him severely. He's half blinded, apparently, and stumbling backwards.
Yes, and he's saved by Ferenz, who is another centaur, which I don't think I mentioned. Also, there's stuff about Ferenz's name. Ferenz is the Italian name for the city of Florence.
Okay.
And that is, this is an argument made by the Harry Potter Wiki. Galileo lived out his final days in Florence, Italy, which is going with that whole stargazing astrology thing.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that idea. Ferenz chases off Voldemort, rescues Harry, and lets Harry ride on his pack.
Yes. So he, you know, the forest is not safe at this time, especially for you. Can you ride? It will be quicker this way. So it's not Harry's like, oh, let's get out of here quick.
Harry's not like, bow down to me, centaur. I'm going to ride on your back. Friends offers.
Yeah, it'll be quicker this way. I just have to get you out of here.
Yeah.
Let's go. And as soon as Harry gets onto his back, the other two centaurs, Bane and Ronan, come in, and Bane is very angry.
Yeah, he's upset that Ferenz is letting a human ride on him. He's saying, we're not just here for rides. We're not servants.
Yeah. What are you doing? You have a human on your back. Have you no shame? Are you a common mule?
Yeah. And they're also upset because Ronan and Bane are looking to follow the stars. They're looking to follow that fate that's been laid out for them.
Yeah, they have foreseen the future, reading the planets.
And they're not going to do anything about it.
They're just going to let it happen.
Yes. Whereas Ferenz is willing to intervene. He stops Voldemort from coming at Harry, thereby, in a sense, defying fate.
Yes.
Defying this destiny that's been laid out. So I wrote a bit about this, and it's probably incoherent, but I don't trust myself enough to speak all my thoughts offhand. So I'm just going to read what I wrote down, if you don't want to
get your, you printed this out?
Oh, I had a lot to say.
All right, I'll just sit back for a little bit.
Well, you have to listen. There's this interesting little moral conundrum in this chapter with the centaurs. So as we talked about, the centaurs are stargazers and can see at least somewhat into the future. They believe in the will of the cosmos and they don't want to intervene. They choose not to exercise their agency, which is something I was talking about before with Harry and agency and moral rules. Harry will always act. The centaurs choose to just sit aside and let things happen, and they don't believe in intervening. They believe this is the destiny laid out by the universe, the cosmos, whatever kind of higher being, and we're not going to do anything about it. We're just going to follow it. So it's similar in ways to in philosophy, like natural law. People that believe God has this vision for us and for the universe, and it's preset, and I'm just going to go along with it. Of course, the centaurs don't seem to be responding to one god. They seem to be responding to this other, not deity, but what's laid out by the stars.
Yes.
It's kind of a more pagan version of it, I would say. So they believe in following the will of the cosmos and intervening. They choose not to exercise their agency. Harry, however, we see is the picture of agency. He lives by his own will and his sense of right or wrong. Ferenz chooses to defy the natural law of the centaurs and help Harry when he meets Voldemort in the forest. And he says that he hopes Ronan and Bane read the stars wrong, implying that astrology is something naturally fallible, that following this destiny that you feel is laid out for you is something naturally fallible. Because that destiny, first of all, could not be true. It could be misread. And that's not what you do. You don't just sit there and take it. You see what I'm saying there?
Yes. Ferenz even says, I set myself against what is lurking in the forest. Bane, yes, with humans alongside me if I must.
Yes. So he is encouraging Harry in his path.
Yeah, he's saying, like, this is what I want to happen. I'll side with whoever I need to make sure that this evil doesn't regain power.
Yeah. And we see a lot of people that choose throughout the series to just kind of sit back and not act and not stand against injustice. And that's very much the people that Harry is pitted against throughout the series. So I think this is maybe the first time that this is showing up, at least in such a heavy-handed way. This battle between fate and destiny and accepting what you believe is fate and destiny and it's just going to happen and standing up against that and choosing to fight against that. And fate and destiny is something really important in the Harry Potter series. And we see in some ways how it's inescapable. But I think Harry is very unwilling to let these external forces control him, whether it is the rules of the school or what people say is meant to happen. Harry is very much just like, well, this is what I believe is right, and this is what I believe is wrong, and I'm always going to stand for that, no matter what anybody else says, no matter what fate or destiny tell me. Mm-hmm. And we see that, too, in the Sorting Hat chapter, that the Sorting Hat is telling him, like, you do really well in Slytherin. There's something in you that points to Slytherin. And Harry says, that's not what I want, though. That's not what I feel is right. So I think that that's kind of a recurring theme going out throughout the series. And there are, you know, higher discussions to have about agency and free will that I'm not smart enough and don't remember my philosophy classes well enough to get into too much. I'm sure you could make a whole thing about that. But it's interesting that Rowling draws this distinction too with the centaurs here, because many philosophers argue that it is our ability to exercise agency and free will that separates us from animals. So, like, think about, like, Nietzsche's sheep metaphor, that the people that just follow along are sheep. comparing them to animals. Ronin and Bane are more horse than man. At the very least, they're very primitive, and they follow astrology and the supposed fate that the stars tell them. Ferenz and Harry are willing to defy that fate and exercise agency, the implication being that is what makes them human. That is what makes them good, what makes them strong. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you. One thing I was thinking about, you brought up the Sorting Hat chapter and how Harry says, okay, I'm not going to go with Slytherin, even though I could be more powerful. I need to go with Gryffindor. At that point, he has a very limited knowledge of
what exactly Slytherin is.
What Slytherin is, what Gryffindor is. All he knows really is the big guy that showed up at my house told me Slytherin was bad and Gryffindor was good.
Well, also he makes friends with Ron, who's like, everybody I know is in Gryffindor, and he meets Malfoy and he's like, I don't want anything to do with that kid, and he really wants to be in Slytherin. But yes, he doesn't
so
have
he's
a total
seen,
yet.
He's had one adult tell him what's up, and he's seen two children, and those are the three things he's making his decision off of.
Yeah.
So he has that agency, but he's going in with such limited knowledge, and that's something that continues throughout the series. He's got this agency. He has this desire to do what's right. He doesn't always know.
Yeah.
You know, he often makes correct decisions, but he doesn't have that full all-knowing. He doesn't know what's happening all the time.
Yeah.
He doesn't have all the insight that, like, Ferenz has.
Yeah.
Ferenz is reading the stars. He's seeing that future and making agency and using his agency. He's making these choices, while Harry just kind of jumps into things.
Sure, yes. I don't want to discount Harry's sense of justice and agency, though, here. Yes, he's often working off of a limited tool set, like you're saying. Like, he's not coming at these things with all the facts, because the facts are being withheld from him. But yeah.
Yeah, so there's that sense of justice, but there's also that just...
blindness, I want to say.
Yeah, it's... blindness, just like there's a lot of assumptions he has to make.
Yeah. And Harry is very much a kind of jump in and I'll figure it out type of guy, which is why Hermione is so important, because she kind of counterbalances that. And we see that especially with this book in the coming two chapters. Harry is not coming about this with all the facts. He has a lot of misunderstandings here that he has made conclusions based on her perceptions, but her perceptions are often flawed. And that's what makes him an interesting character. If he always knew everything and did everything right, these books wouldn't be that much fun to read.
No, I know. It's a very big distinction between him and Ferenz, even if they're both, acting with their own will and trying to get something to happen.
Well, yeah. Ferenz definitely has more knowledge than Harry. Like, my next note is, how does Ferenz know that the stone is hidden in the school? But Ferenz also acknowledges that he is basing a lot of his understandings and perceptions off of the stargazing of the centaurs. I'm sure he has gotten information from Hagrid and his other apparent sources in the forest that he knows these secrets about Hogwarts, probably Hagrid.
Hagrid may not be good at keeping secrets.
But he is willing to say that his perceptions are based off of something flawed, like astrology and stargazing. He's like, I hope that what the stars are telling us is not right. I hope that we're reading it wrong.
And he does emphasize they have been wrong before.
Yeah. So absolutely what you're saying is right, that Harry is, you know, working from less knowledge than people. But I do think that it is a very intentional thing that Rowling is setting up here, of the people who just sit by and watch and do nothing, and people like Harry who choose to act. That was my big point.
You're only just now flipping to the other side.
The other side is a lot shorter.
So you've got something else to read?
Not about the forest.
So we're good to go on?
We're good to go on from the forest.
All right.
So Ferenz takes Harry back to Hagrid.
Yeah, during this ride, Ferenz is...
he's answering questions for Harry. They stop at one point and he does like a big info dump.
For most of it, he's not answering Harry's questions.
Yeah.
He's just like... silently ignoring him.
I think the idea is eventually to get far enough away from the danger that he has a safe point to talk to Harry in private.
Well, that, and he seems deliberate in what he's giving to Harry. He's not willing to answer everything.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking to give Harry the bare minimum while also giving him enough to get through what's about to come at him. So it's clear that Ferenz knows more than he's letting on.
Yeah. And that's something that we'll see repeatedly throughout this series, that like controlled trickle of knowledge to Harry.
Yeah.
Not telling him quite enough to let him understand things, but enough to sort of push him in the direction that he should go.
So he does say at one point, do you know what is hidden in the school at this very moment? After talking about the unicorn blood keeps you alive, but only barely.
Yeah. And somebody's looking for something better. Do you know what's hidden right now? The elixir of life.
Yeah.
And of course, Harry says yes.
So I'm willing to guess that Hagrid is
spilling
some secrets.
I mean, it seems like him and Ferenz know each other, and Ferenz seems like the most sane of all the centaurs. So I could see Hagrid treating Ferenz as a confidant, but yeah, Hagrid should be keeping his mouth shut.
but it also might be like a respect thing. You live in this area as well. Things might start happening. I could see Dumbledore giving that kind of information
to the centaurs. Yeah, that's a good point. Is it Ferenz too that basically tells Harry that that was Voldemort?
Yes.
Okay.
Let me see exactly whether Ferenz knew exactly what was in there. He knows now because after giving that clue, Harry blurts out, "The Sorcerer's Stone, of course, the elixir of life. But I don't understand who." And then Ferenz says, "Can you think of nobody who has waited many years to return to power, who was clutching to life, awaiting their chance?"
Yeah, and Harry thinks back to what Hagrid told him back in Diagon Alley, that he believes that Voldemort is still out there waiting to regain power. So Harry puts it together with Ferenz's help, and he realizes that, like you were saying 20 minutes ago, it's much bigger than what they thought. It's not just Snape trying to get rich.
Yes.
It's Voldemort. It's the real deal.
But it's just with that in mind, it's weird how much effort they were putting in to try and stop this professor from just making money.
Yeah. We could take this as a commentary on how poorly paid teachers are. So, and Harry and Hermione are kind of hitting themselves at that point, too. They're like, not how did we miss this, but it's so much bigger than us now. And that is what leads. So they leave the forest. Harry and Hermione rush to wake up Ron and tell him what happened. And Hermione at last suggests that they take their information on Snape to Dumbledore, because I think that she's realizing, like, this isn't child's play anymore. There's something really serious going on here and we need help. And so she turns to Dumbledore. And Harry objects. He says, "We have no proof and no one will ever believe us." And this is also something I think that's recurring throughout the series, is that like when people criticize the series and the characters, especially Harry, they say, like, why doesn't he ever just tell an adult what's happening? Why doesn't he ever get help? And I think that that ignores a lot of the character that we've seen up to this point, that Harry is a victim of abuse, that he has been taught repeatedly by the Dursleys, do not trust adults. Adults are not there to help you. And this is, it's a sign of abuse too, the distrust of adults, you know, not being willing to go to adults for help because adults have hurt you. Yeah. And so we like to frame the narrative of the books often as like Harry versus evil, Harry versus irresponsible and corrupt authority figures. But that's not always what's happening. There's something much deeper here that we see that Ron and Hermione don't have Harry's distrust of adults, because they are used to adult figures that are there to help them. Hermione believes that the teachers are there to help them. And Ron has a loving family that supports him. And he also, I think, to an extent, believes that adults are there to help him, with the exception of adults like Snape that are out to get him. Whereas for Harry, everybody is at the very least out to get him or won't believe him, won't help him. And I think that is because he was abused for 11 years and he had all these adults in his life, presumably his teachers at school, Mrs. Fig, and even, he doesn't know this, but like Dumbledore and all the other magical people watching over him.
Knew that whole time and just didn't do anything about it.
So it absolutely makes sense to me that Harry wouldn't want to go to adults with this information and would choose to take things into his own hands. And even with somebody like Dumbledore, who to this point, Harry has no reason to distrust Dumbledore. In fact, after the Mirror of Erised chapter, I think that he does feel he has this kind of relationship and connection to Dumbledore, but he still is not willing to like go and ask for help.
But I think he raises a very good point. You know, they gave this information to Hagrid, who trusts them, but knows that, like, oh, and like, yeah, dismisses it. But like, he, it's not like he's saying there's no way that's true. He's just saying like, this is a professor.
Yeah.
I'm going to trust the professor. He's not like looking down on these children because they're children. He's saying like, I trust Snape because Snape is to be trusted. Dumbledore trusts Snape.
Yeah. And Snape. I think that's setting up a very classic like childhood feeling of like, the adults don't trust me. The adults all trust each other. They're going to protect themselves.
Coming to anyone with absolutely no proof saying he's going to do this and resurrect Lord Voldemort, who lives in the forest murdering unicorns.
Yeah. And so I'm ready to talk about the end of the chapter if you are.
This is just occurring to me now. Professor McGonagall says, especially these days, about it being so dangerous out at night. Does she know at that point about the unicorns? Because one had just been killed like
that
Wednesday before. So she knows at least that much and enough to send four children out to look for whatever is killing those.
Which is, I think, it's not a plot hole, but I think it is a hole in this book of how did the teachers not know what's going on? They know that the stone is there. They know that something is happening in the forest. How they're not putting together all of this information.
How they're not thinking Lord Voldemort has showed up for the first time in 11 years.
Well, there is a character that kind of has a suspicion, but I can't talk about it without getting into spoilers. So we'll leave that.
We'll leave it.
We'll leave that for the next two episodes. Yes, but Harry gets the cloak back at the end of the chapter. It's waiting for him in the dormitory.
Yeah, with a note, just in case, which we have to assume is Dumbledore, who has already told Harry he knows about the cloak.
Yes.
And is very okay with him having it.
And again, it's frustrating because that note implies that Dumbledore knows to some extent what's going on here, that Harry might be placing himself in danger and is not doing anything about it. But again, that's getting into stuff we can't talk about yet.
Yep.
So we will leave this chapter at that.
But that's what I do like about going back through this series. Yes, there's a lot we can't talk about yet. Mm-hmm. But the idea that there's so much we can't talk about yet, that goes all the way back to this first book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've been saying that since chapter one.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's why I think this series bears rereading so well. Because every time you go back to it, you're like, oh, I suddenly understand why this character is behaving this way. And I suddenly understand why this thing that seemed like a plot hole before actually makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of the quality of these books early on. I think it takes a couple books for Rowling to learn to be a writer.
I mean, it's...
We've had this conversation a lot.
Yes. It's tough to say, like, was she not as great as of a writer, or was she writing for children?
A younger audience? I think it's both. I think she was writing for a young audience and she hadn't really found her voice as a writer yet.
She's she definitely improved her writing over time. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. She improved her writing over time and she started to skew older.
Yes.
For her age set. But I think we have to acknowledge that the prose here is not as advanced as it could be. Anyway, let's talk about Spell of the Week.
Alrighty then, let me bring this up. And for Spell of the Week, we have a charm famously used by my friend Neville Longbottom when he was spooked by Malfoy in the forest. Taught to them, hopefully not only by Hagrid minutes before being sent into the forest, the Red Sparks charm, which the incantation for is Vermilius. Which likely derives from vermilion, a term for a shade of brilliant red.
Also a city in Pokemon.
All the Pokemon cities are named after colors.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted you to, I wanted to make sure you knew that.
I do.
Okay, good. That's why Pallet Town is so cool.
That I did not realize until very recently, but go
We're
on.
Not
Harry
getting
Potter.
Into this now. It's a jet of red sparks that come out of your wand. It can also be used as an offensive spell, but like it's very minor. You know, if you're also dueling another 11-year-old, that might work well.
Under appearances on the Harry Potter wiki, does it say Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets on the Game Boy Color? Because I think there's a spell called Vermilius in that one, but I can't remember which
Game Boy Color version. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. The best Harry Potter game. Go on.
So far from correct. yes, it is used in a lot of the video games.
But the interesting thing about the Game Boy Color one is I think that it's a greenish spell in the Harry Potter game.
You may be thinking of a slightly different spell, which is the green one with the incantation being Verdumilius.
I will have to replay the game to find out.
No.
Go on. Sorry. And what's the red one? I'm sorry. Now I'm getting it twisted.
Vermilius.
Vermilius. Okay.
But yes, so the Red Sparks incantation is Vermilius, and there's not much to say other than it's used in this chapter and not again for another two books.
Okay. That's spell of the week then, I guess. And our episode. So, to do my closure, unless you have any lingering stray thoughts.
Is J.K. Rowling racist?
I don't know. The books have problems with race. So, you can send us an email at owlpost@podtrificustotalis.com. With your thoughts on our conversation about this chapter. Maybe if you know more about philosophy than me, you can have a more intelligent commentary on what's going on here with free will and agency. But yeah, owlpost.podtrificustotalis.com. You can send us your thoughts, your experiences with the Harry Potter series, your corrections for any oopsies that we might make. You can follow us on Twitter at Podtrificus. You can follow us on Tumblr. You can like us on Facebook. We are on all of the social media pretty much. And of course you
Do we have an Instagram?
No, because all of the podcast Instagrams that I've seen are usually like, hey, we're in the recording studio and our recording studio is a messy second bedroom. And then, of course, you can subscribe to us. We are on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts and whatever other podcast things. You don't like when I use the word podcatcher, but we are on all podcatchers. Yeah, so subscribe to us and leave us a review if you are so inclined. We like to hear that nice feedback about us. And, you know, if you have critiques, that's something to let us know about, too. Yeah, so you can leave us a review, follow us, subscribe to us, just talk to us, send us an email, that kind of good stuff. And you can join us again for chapter 16.
Through the Trap Door.